moving on, we've been talking a lot about different countries and what they look like in our post-American series. And recently we talked about Germany. Is there any chance that immigration, migration could help mitigate some of the issues that they see in the coming years?
In order for immigration to really help, it has to be something that's done over a long period of time so that you can absorb the cultural shock of having different sorts of people assimilate into your society. The problem with Germany is they started so late in that process and their demographics are so far down that they would have to bring in now 2 million people a year for the next 25 years in order to repair. Actually, that's more like just to hold it where it is right now. And if you do that, then the vast majority of the people who live in Germany would no longer be German. So the only countries to this point that have been able to integrate immigration into their identity are the settler states, New Zealand, Australia, the United States, and Canada. And of those, Canada is the only one who's been able to do it at a scale that changes the complexity of the country without also generating a massive backlash.
Is there any credibility to the idea that the Hamas and Israel war was concocted by Russia and China as a diversion for the Americans?
No. I mean, don't get me wrong. They're happy that it happened, but Hamas did this on its own time frame. The Iranians may have a nudge them to do it at a specific month as opposed to in general, but this was all Hamas trying to change the math. If Hamas had not done this, then you'd be seeing the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, basically just slipping further and further into irrelevance, and they found a way to change that. They've been working on this for years, and they would have done it regardless of what happened in Moscow and Beijing. That doesn't mean that Moscow and Beijing are unhappy with what's happening.
This one might not be a quick one either. So our rapid questions are falling apart quickly, but can food insecurity in the Gulf countries be subdued by ramping up the Sudanese agriculture industry?
No. Sudan is one of the least productive agricultural zones in the world. They deal with an alluvial system like the Egyptians do, but they don't nearly have nearly as much river flow, even if the security situation was solved. And no. You're still talking about it taking at least a generation of first world technologies coming in to overhaul this place, and that's not going to happen. South Africa is a much better choice.
Good segue. I know we'll probably touch on this in our post-American series, but could you give us a glimpse at some of the economic concerns in South Africa and then coming decades?
South Africa has been so mismanaged for so long, we're starting to see the bones crack. Physical infrastructure, especially power infrastructure, is failing. And without a significant overhaul in governance structures and an end to corruption, it's only going to get worse. That makes it very difficult for the South Africans to do high-scale agriculture, manufacturing of every sort, and they're even now starting to see problems in processing the raw materials. These are big problems that are honestly normally really easy to fix. But the after effects of having an incompetent president like Mbeki and a deliberately corrupt president like Zuma, you don't just fix that in a year or five. And the current president has proven that he's just not capable of bringing all the factions of the ANC, that's the ruling political party, together to try something new. And that means South Africa is fading. That's one big problem. The second big problem is just the general population. The deal that was struck between the outgoing apartheid government and the incoming black government was that the whites could keep everything that they earned and built during the apartheid era, and in exchange, the blacks would live free, free housing. But that means they all live in slums. They barely have electricity and they don't have plumbing. So you've got half the population who basically lives in shanty towns that is unemployed. And that means that the country is not even using its own population, which is the perfect recipe for all of that corruption that is hobbling everything else. So South Africa should be a wildly successful country, but it's going to require a political transformation for that to happen.
We've heard your thoughts on the UK, and some of them are negative. What do you see the UK-US trade relationship look like over the next 30 years?
Brexit is now, 7 years behind us, and the Brits still haven't figured out what's next. Back when Brexit was being discussed, people would ask me what I thought about Brexit. Like, you know, I don't think the European Union is going to last. So there's something to be said for getting out early and getting a jump start on what's next. they haven't done that. They're just in this netherworld of negotiations that they can barely manage themselves. Until such time as the Brits bite the bullet and move on, it's difficult to have a positive opinion about anything that's going on in London. They're losing the financial sector. Their housing sector is still overblown, U.S. subprime style, and their manufacturing is just withering. The only road forward that I can find is for the UK to sign a trade deal with a country that has stronger demographic growth and therefore stronger consumption. And the only country on the table is the United States, but that means you have to do it from the US's point of view. So in the early post-Brexit days, when the Brits came to the United States to ask for a deal, they were working from the ridiculous positions that the Brexiteers had during Brexit, that they could get a much, much, much better deal from the United States than they could for Brussels. Well, that was never true. And so when they saw the terms of the deal, all the blood ran out of their face. And then Biden came in and they tried again. And it's the same deal. So until such time as the Brits realize that they're going to be a subservient power to the United States, and that's a big pill to swallow, they're in this in-between. And it's killing them. We know how the story is going to end. We know how it has to end. But until the Brits realize and can accept that the deal they're going to get from the US is worse than the deal they had with the EU, they're just stalled.
All right, let's look at labor here. We've got a couple questions, kind of rapid fire. What does the future of blue collar work look like?
Oh, it's gold. We need to double the size of the industrial plant in the United States. That's a lot of industrial construction. And we need to massively expand our manufacturing footprint, at least by a factor of two, probably by a factor of three. Those are almost all blue-collar jobs. And we've had the lowest birth rate in the history of the United States for the last 15 years. So the incoming generation of the workforce, Gen Z, is the smallest generation we've ever had. And the baby boomers, the largest generation we've ever had, is now leaving the workforce. So we have a massive shortage of workers and a need to massively expand the number of blue-collar workers we have.
Is there any chance that the boomers will be welcomed back into, you know, their old jobs, and that can help mitigate some of the fallout here?
So far, most of the trends are going the opposite direction. A lot of boomers took early retirement during COVID, and hardly any of them have come back. Now, any boomers who decide to bring their skill sets to bear in this environment are going to be able to do very well for themselves personally. Remember, we have a primarily white-collar economy. There aren't a lot of boomers out there who do blue-collar work, and blue-collar work, once you hit your mid-60s, is almost a non-option because of physical constraints. So there are going to be some individuals who make some mad money out of this. But overall, I don't think they're going to be able to be enough of them to take the sting out of what the rest of us are going to have to deal with.
Hey, you've answered this before, but how about AI? Can that help increase productivity and help with some of this, or is it
potentially there are any number of sectors where automation and artificial intelligence of some form can bring a lot of productivity. I'd say the big ones are agriculture in terms of increasing output, whether from GMOs or digital gardening. Number two would be manufacturing in terms of automation. Number three would be finance in terms of efficiency. Number four would be defense and crypto in the classic sense in terms of cybersecurity as opposed to alternate currencies. The problem I think we're going to have is that the type of chips that are necessary to do AI at scale all come from one city in Taiwan, and their supply chain that allows those facilities to function is spread out around the world, and most of it only does one thing for one end customer. So if deglobalization and depopulation come for any major country in the world, we lose the chunk of the environment, of the ecosystem that is necessary to do those chips. So we're probably going to be able to pick one of those four in order to apply AI to help. But that's going to be a government decision as to which one of those four happens. Until we can build out the environment to allow those chips to be made in multiple locations and a more reliable security environment, I don't think AI is going to be a huge part of the solution because we're just not going to be able to produce the chips.